and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration will be part four from Our Neglected Heritage by Gladys Taylor. And the chapter is titled Onwards to Britain. And it begins with the triad of Paul the Apostle, which says, "The three luxuries of a Christian feast, what God has prepared, what can be obtained with justice to all, what love to all may venture to use." If so great a work was done by the first century saints in Gaul, yet the British Church was always given precedence at church councils up to the time of the Reformation because of its antiquity, we can only assume that the spread of faith in this land was very great and the response immediate. The arrival of Joseph of Arimathea and his 11 companions at Glastonbury took place over 20 years before St. Paul's arrival in Rome. 4 years were to elapse before Claudius ascended the throne of the Caesars, and another 9 years before Caractacus and his family were captured. When we consider the earnestness and mobility of these saints, we know that it was possible for the Christian truth to spread widely throughout southern England and Wales, if not further afield. In fact, the British royal family could have accepted the Christian faith before being taken to Rome. Archaeologists have been amazed to discover, in recent years, a large number of Cairo monograms in Romano-British buildings. This symbol, consisting of the first two letters of the name of Christ in Greek, is quite distinctive and unmistakable. The most striking example was found in a beautifully preserved mosaic floor at Hinton St. Mary in Dorset. At the centre of the design is a head with the Cairo behind it. It could well be a portrait of the owner of the house, with the symbol which would show him to be a Christian. In Canterbury Museum is a silver spoon with the Cairo engraved on it, dated by the experts as the 2nd century. In the villa at Icklingham in Suffolk is a lead tank with both the Cairo and the Alpha and Omega on it. Near Ely, a pewter cup was found with a typical Celtic zoomorphic pattern or animal design around the rim, with one prominent part of the pattern being a clear Cairo with Alpha and Omega on either side of it. A number of lead tanks have been found, leading to the conclusion that they may have been used for adult baptism. The missionaries regarded a baptistry as essential that converts might be baptized immediately. Joan Liversidge, in her recent book, Britain in the Roman Empire, devotes 8 pages to the evidences of Christianity in Roman Britain. She speaks of a number of buildings which appear to be chapels, but have no distinctly Christian marks about them, though one was found at Silchester with an obvious baptistry beside it. Then she gives a thrilling account of the piecing together of a broken wall at Lullingstone in Kent, where rich Romano-British finds have been made, and the finding of a fresco painted in the exact style of those in the catacombs of Rome, with two large Cairo emblems on different walls, both enclosed in garlands of flowers. When we consider what a fraction of the whole the objects uncovered must be, we are led to the inevitable conclusion that not only were there many Christians in Britain in Roman times, but they are found spread out over a wide area. Other emblems used by Christians have been found, but they are not as distinctive as those mentioned. One of the most striking discoveries was the word puzzle, found on the wall of a Roman building in Cirencester. It consists of a number of Latin words which did not seem to convey any important meaning, but it was discovered that the letters, if rearranged, formed a cross which read in each direction, across and downwards. Paternoster, our Father, with Alpha and Omega forming the ends of the arms. We are mainly dependent upon Welsh records for our early English history, since the destruction wrought by successive invasions from the Boadicean War onwards destroyed many important documents. The fire at Glastonbury Abbey in 1184 finished the process with the destruction of the great library in which John of Glastonbury, William of Malmesbury, and the other writers had studied. Fortunately, much is available from those Welsh sources, which, together with Roman records, notably Tacitus, and writings such as those of Bede and the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, give us clues to the conditions of that time. We learn from them what happened to the British royal family. St. Donat's Castle in South Wales is locally known as Caradoc's Castle. Within a few miles is Llantwit Major, where the church was founded by Eurgain, one of the daughters of Caractacus. This must indeed be one of the oldest churches in Britain, and it was certainly one of the most important. Early stone walls of unknown age are embodied in the modern church, and the guidebook tells us its story. Llantwit Major was originally named Car Urgan, after the Princess Urgain. Then it became known as Bangor Urgain, Bangor meaning high choir. Urgain had founded there a Christian Druidic college for 12 students. This was the small beginning, as at Glastonbury, but this church became one of the great choirs of Britain, hence the name Bangor, which was applied to a number of places associated with the Celtic Church. Two are still known by that name, in North Wales and on Belfast Lough. Both these places were great training centres for the early church. At the Cor Urgain, or the Choir of Urgain, it was customary to sing praises to God continuously, day and night, as in Solomon's Temple. Here was the beginning of the great choirs of the Celtic Church, and it is striking to see how often the leading churches were situated where the notable Druidic centres had been before. The more we know of Druidism, the more we realise what a wonderful preparation for Christianity it must have been. Much nonsense is written and spoken about it, without any attempt to discover what Celtic literature tells us. The triads, both of Wales and Ireland, tell us much of the Druidic wisdom, which did not conflict with the truth brought by Christian missionaries. A knowledge of our identity helps us to understand the likenesses between the Israelite and Druidic priesthoods. The earliest migrations to Britain took place before Israel turned to paganism, and we can well believe that it was in the mind of God that the faith of these islands should receive a good foundation. There were minority movements towards pagan cults, but Druidism was always dominant. In the Triads, we read that Bran the Blessed, the father of Caractacus, was an arch-druid. The Christian druids, mentioned in connection with Bangor Urgain, were Culdies, and Culdie churches were numerous in Wales, Scotland and Ireland. In the Highlands of Scotland are many churches founded among the Picts by saints who are unknown outside that area and are remembered as Culdies. Brecon, which has the only round tower in Scotland, on the pattern of those in Ireland, was a notable Culdie training centre. One of the British princes who is widely remembered as the last of the Romans, because he was ruling in Britain at the time of the Roman Empire's decline, was Ambrosius Aurelianus, the uncle of King Arthur. Both British and Latin histories refer to him. The town of Amesbury in Wiltshire is named after him, Ambersburn. He is described as the founder of the great sanctuary of Neo-Druidism. And that's from A. Herbert's Britannia After the Romans. Also known as the fountainhead of Bardic doctrine. Heath's Guide to Wiltshire tells us that he is identified by Dr. Guest with Nathan Loud, the prince of the sanctuary. It also informs us that the choir of the sanctuary of Ambrosius was probably the monastery of Britain, the centre from which flowed the blessings of Christianity and civilization. Statements such as these are confusing to many people because they do not see the connection between Druidism and Christianity. To students of British Israel identity, It is as close as that between the Old Testament and the New. Druidism anticipated Christianity. In the Druidic Trinity, Khisu was the recreator of the future. When Jesus came, he was the fulfillment, both in name and in character, of their anticipations. The Caldy Monastery of Ambrosius was set up, according to William of Malmesbury, to keep back the influence of the pagan Saxons, while Arthur led the united armies of the Britons in an attempt to defend Britain from their invasion. Arthur was not to know that the Saxons were brethren who must be one for Christ, just as Alfred, the Saxon king, was to discover later that the invading Norsemen were brethren whom he was eventually to evangelize. If we look at Urgain's background, we shall find that it was purely Druidic. Her grandfather was Bran the Blessed, and her great-grandfather, if we are to keep to the Silurian family, was Clear Hlediath, the ancestor also of the kings of Dumnonia, which is Cornwall, Devon and Somerset, including Uther and his son Arthur. Her husband was Salog, the prince of Old Sarum near Salisbury. It seems more than probable that he was responsible for founding the monastery at Amesbury, which is listed among the great choirs of Britain. The later work of Ambrosius appears to have been a revival of an existing centre rather than the institution of a new one. If a nation is to be regarded as Christian when its king and most of his subjects accept the faith, then the date for Britain would appear to be around AD 58. Bran the Blessed, always in Welsh literature regarded as the first Christian king, is the subject of Triad 35 of the Triads of the Cymry, which tells us Bran the Blessed, son of Hlir Hlediath, who first brought Christianity among the Cymry from Rome, where he had been for 7 years as an hostage for his son Caractacus. This is about the time that Paul wrote his letter to the Romans. It was when Bran returned to Britain that, according to the Welsh genealogy, Ashiel Saint Prydain, our first bishop of Britain, Aristobulus, began his episcopate. Quote, "These came with Bran the Blessed from Rome to Britain. Aristuli Hen, which means Aristobulus the Aged, Ilid, Cundau, Men of Israel, Manor, son of Aristuli Hen." The strange way in which Aristobulus is mentioned, with his two friends as Men of Israel, with his son given after, as though he were not a man of Israel, leads us to wonder, was Manor perhaps born when his father was in Rome, leaving the genealogist a little doubtful as to whether to call him a man of Israel? More is known of Aristobulus than most of his companions, as he is mentioned in a number of martyrologies, one from as far away as Greece. From these references, we can build up a picture of our first bishop. Saint Aedo, Archbishop of Vienna, in the Rhone Valley during the 9th century, tells us that he was the brother of Saint Barnabas the Apostle, by whom he was ordained bishop. Hippolytus, writing early in the 3rd century, speaks of him plainly as the Bishop of the British. Saint Dorotheus, writing AD 300, tells us Aristobulus, whom Paul saluted, writing to the Romans, was bishop of Britain. The longest and most comprehensive reference to him is found in the Greek Menology, which is a collection of notes concerning the saints, collected from all the Eastern churches by the command of the Emperor Basilius of Macedonia during the 9th century. It reads, "Aristobulus was one of the 70 disciples and a follower of St. Paul the Apostle, along with whom he preached the gospel to the whole world and ministered unto him. He was chosen by St. Paul to be the missionary bishop to the land of Britain." Here is an interesting detail. No wonder he was described as the missionary bishop, for the Lord himself sent out his 70 disciples. Before his brother, the Apostle Barnabas, ordained him, before St. Paul sent him, the Lord himself had given him the most important ordination of all. The Menology closes with these words, "He was there martyred after he had built churches and ordained deacons and priests for the island." near the source of the River Severn in Montgomeryshire, is a place called Aristolly, named after him, where Aristobulus is said to have suffered martyrdom. Saint Dorotheus also writes of Saint Simon Zelotes, an apostle who is not mentioned again after our Lord's resurrection. Was he also absent from the east? Dorotheus tells us Simon Zelotes traversed all Mauritania in North Africa and the region of the Africans, preaching Christ. He was at last crucified, slain, and buried in Britain. The region is believed to be in Lincolnshire. There is a second reference to this martyrdom in the Chronologic, written during the 9th century by Nicephorus, the Patriarch of Constantinople. What a company of the elect were found gathering on these shores. It would seem from the Welsh references that Caer Ergain was a popular place for them to gather. Perhaps that is the reason why so many triads were preserved in Wales, bearing the names of distinguished guests. One is the contribution made by Hlid, one of the companions of Aristobulus, who is described as Saint of the Race of Israel. Hlid is the Celtic form of his name. We have not yet discovered what name he bore in Palestine. Lazarus must have visited his friends in Britain. Sometime in his busy life as the Bishop of Marseille, for the Triad of Lazarus is preserved, the only words attributed to him in any literature. We know St. Paul by his letters. Among the writings referring to his coming to Britain are the Welsh triads of Paul the Apostle, no less than 10 in number. They are full of Christian wisdom, and there is no reason to doubt their authenticity. Clemens Romanus speaks of Paul going to the extremity of the West, and then returning to Rome and suffering martyrdom before the sovereigns of mankind. Clement, Bishop of Rome, should know the truth of the matter. Jerome and Chrysostom refer to Paul travelling to the extreme west, and Theodore, the Syrian bishop of the 5th century, tells us that he preached Christ's gospel to the Britons and others in the west. Even the Pope, wishing to please some important British visitors in 1931, advanced the theory that it was St. Paul himself, and not Pope Gregory, who first introduced Christianity into Britain. We nailed that piece of news reported in the Morning Post of March 27th with delight. We knew the truth, but here was the Pope voicing it too, an unprecedented event. As to the place of St. Paul's arrival in Britain, we have a little local history given by a Miss Hargrove in an old history of the Isle of Wight. She speaks of St. Paul arriving with several other Christians, some of whom had been in personal contact with our Blessed Lord himself. He landed at Bonefon in the Isle of Wight. The exact spot is now Sandown Bay, which was a mouth of the harbour of Brading. He passed to the mainland from Ryde, the ferry or passage now called Ryde, to Abadeo, the port of God, or God's port, or now known as Gosport. This is not so fantastic as it may seem, for nearby Paul's Grove, north of Portsmouth, is said to be so named because St. Paul visited there. And we will finish up with a small chapter here, which is following the previous one that I just read, and it's called The Women's Part, and begins with a quote from Marshall. For mountains, bridges, rivers, churches, and fair women, Britain is past compare. It will have been noticed that all through this study of the first century church, the women have been very prominent, playing a necessary part, without apparently any undue self-assertion, for they were universally loved by their fellow Christians. It is popularly supposed that women had no rights until the time of the suffragettes. This is not true. There is a triad in the laws of Malmutius, giving the three property birthrights of every Briton, one being the right of suffrage in the enacting of the laws, to the male at 21 and the female on her marriage. In ancient Israel, the women were treated with respect and consideration. The wives of the patriarchs have a queenly nobility, and there are indications that the unusual freedom of women was strange to their pagan neighbours. This we tend to forget because, in the time of our Lord, Judeans had copied too much in the ways of Babylon, and their women were treated as mere chattels. We find Jesus rescuing some of them from degradation and treating his women friends as persons worthy of respect. Mary sat at his feet like a student, studying under a master, and Jesus did not permit that good part that she had chosen to be taken from her. When eventually this group of women arrived in Western Europe, they worked along with the men for the evangelization of the Celtic people. It was not only the men who founded churches, though there is no evidence that the women ever wanted to be ordained as bishops. They were carrying out with complete naturalness the work that must be done. The royal British ladies in Rome were of the same order. There was no apparent self-consciousness. They were earnest and practical, even burying with their own hands their martyred friends, as the inscription in the church of St. Pudentiana tells us. Rome treated women as worse than chattels, and has passed on its habits in the nations of Europe which are under the Roman dominance. But Claudia and her daughters were Celts, and Celtic women were unusually self-possessed. It was a fact which surprised the Romans greatly. In a recent book entitled The Celtic Realms, we read, Cartimandua is one of the outstanding women rulers of Celtic antiquity. Comparable with her contemporary Queen Boudica of the Iceni, and with the heroic age Queen of Ireland, Queen Medeb of Connaught. It is indeed impossible to have any true understanding of either Celtic history or Celtic literature without realizing the high status of Celtic women, and something of the nature of their place in society in both Gaul and Britain. Polybius speaks of them following their husbands in wagons when they went to battle against the Romans. Of course, a bad queen could be as dangerous as a bad king, as we see in the case of Cartimandua or Cartismandua, who betrayed Caractacus, but a good one could be a blessing, as we have seen often in our history. So we see also the leadership of Urgain holding court at her new Christian centre and receiving all who came during the rule of her brother Calinus, who acted as regent during his father's absence. Gestin ap Gurgant tells us of him, Celyn ap Caradog, a wise and just king. In his days, many of the Cymry embraced the faith in Christ through the teachings of the saints of Cor Orgain, and many godly men from the countries of Greece and Rome were in Cambria. Such is our heritage, of which we have no need to be ashamed. Thank you very much for listening, and there will be more Albion narrations in the future.